It's the 19th hole with Michael Williams.
Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is the 19th hole with Michael Williams, bringing you the best and the best of golf and golf lifestyle week after week after week after week after week after week. We have a great, great show for you today. One of my very favorite people in the business. He has worked for everybody from Golf Digest to the Golf Channel. He is a photographer. He is an editor. He's a writer. He's a philosopher. Also a pretty nice guy. He's my good friend, Matt Ginella. He will be here to talk about actually just what's good in golf and what's not good in golf and what where he'd like to see golf and all other things that we are interested in. So I am just so glad that you get a chance to listen to that. Love having him in always, and it's going to be a treat, and I hope that you stick around and listen to it. Also with us are Stephanie Luttrell from Titleist, who is in charge of the section that is developing the GT series of drivers in fairway woods. They have some outstanding product, and she's going to tell us a little bit about what her product is, number one, the GT, and also a little bit about her life and how she came into golf and how she sees it, what she wants to do with it. It's a fascinating conversation, I'm sure. So stick with us. One thing I do want to tell you is that this week I got a chance to play the upcoming U.S. Open course, which is Oakmont. For this year, Oakmont being one of the three anchor sites for the U.S. Open, the first being Pinehurst, then Oakmont, then Pebble Beach. And these are all places that I consider anchor sites for good reason. That good reason is you could give them 2 weeks notice that you were coming there with the U.S. Open, and they would say, no problem, bring it on. And it would be one of the best Opens ever. All of these places can do that. Oakmont is unique in that it is, I think, the hardest course in America. It is just ridiculously difficult. And when you get into a situation where you have the open rough coming into play, it's almost difficult to see how anyone plays that course 4 days in a row. It's not only a physical test, it's a mental test as well. A test of your daring, of your imagination, but also of your good sensibilities to keep things in play, to keep things online, and keep them into a place where you're not going to have that one mistake that takes you out of the tournament. We've had such great champions here at Oakmont. Tiger Woods not being among them. He finished second to Angel Cabrera in 2007. But you've had some of the greats of the game win here. And I think most notably the 63 by Johnny Miller in the 1973 Open Championship at Oakmont, which I still consider. There have been other 63s in championship play, but I think his still, to me, is the best. On the final round at Oakmont, there is no better round of golf that's been played than that by Johnny Miller, and I'll tell him so to his face. I have. And I'm telling you, that's one of the best I've ever seen. But Oakmont, the course is fantastic, and even better than the Open being at Oakmont is the people who put it on. And that's everybody from the leadership. That's Mike Wan and Fred Perpall, the two leaders of the organization. You have so many people who are giving their life to making this event and all of the USGA championship events very special, not only for the people who play in them, but for the people who watch them. And I want to give my thanks to all of them for what they do. They are outstanding. They are exceptional people, and they're going to put on an exceptional championship there, and I can't wait to see it. Now, how did I do? Well, I'm happy to report that I had one birdie at Oakmont there, which was on number 9. Hit an approach shot to, I don't know, about 1 foot and a driving rain that just started. I did not care what happened on that shot. I hit loose and freely, and it landed to about a foot, and I was grateful for it. I had 7 pars, and the rest of the holes we will not speak of. They're either bogeys or above, but I think I broke 100 this time, which is a record for me. I did use one ball again, which is kind of a thing. It's very tough to lose a ball there. There's not any water in play on the course, but the rough is so deep that you could actually lose a ball if you didn't have six people looking for it. It's ridiculously high, rough, and difficult. But it's going to be a just an unbelievable test for the best players in the world, which is what they want. Also, kudos to my good friend, John Bodenhamer, who was there at the event, talking about the event, the head of the championship for Oakmont. All of the guys were there, and they're all just so interested in making this event one of the best, if not the best, that you've ever been to. So I encourage you, if you have a chance to go see it, do it. I think you will find that it is the best event that you've ever been to. Certainly seeing the best players on the toughest course in America is worth the while. And I'll be on later with predictions and that sort of thing. But for the one thing that I can say is that the course itself, the main player, will hold up its end of the bargain. It's going to be really, really special. All right, enough about me. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll have Matt Janella and Stephanie Luttrell talking about their work with golf in general and Titleist in general. So go get yourself a cold beverage and a crunchy snack, and we'll be right back. Michael Williams, 19 Hole.
Hey there, Jay Peterman here, John O'Gurley, and you are listening to Mike Williams and the 19th Hole.
Welcome back to the 19th Hole. Michael Williams, your host. And, you know, one of the reasons I love this game so much is because there's so many people who are smart. I don't want to cast aspersions on any other game, any other sport, anybody else who's doing anything else, but I think that there's a lot of people in this game who are sitting on both sides of the microphone who kind of know what's going on. You know, you kind of enjoy talking to them because they have a unique perspective on things. And there are some people who are even a cut above in that level. And falling into that category is my next guest. You know him from the Golf Channel. He is a travel insider. He's a podcast host, a producer, a storyteller. He is, as I said, one heck of a smart guy and also one heck of a nice guy. Please welcome to the 19th Hole, Matt Janella. Matt, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing great, Michael. How are you, buddy? Always good to be on with you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I am doing well. It's the beginning of the golf season, as heralded by the crowning of a Masters champion. And that's where we'll get started, is the last Masters at Augusta National. The birds were singing. The sun was shining. It was kind of a perfect Masters in all ways, especially in the crowning of Rory McIlroy as a champion. What were your thoughts on this last Masters, and your thoughts on Rory as a champion?
Well, I think very few Masters, certainly Sundays at the Masters, live up to expectations, because we have such high expectations as it is, right? The back nine on Sunday, Masters, and then you have a leaderboard like we had this year, which ratchets up the expectations and the anticipation of what would be drama. To match those expectations is very rare. To exceed those expectations is even more rare. And for the guy to have made two double bogeys, beat the guy who made 10 natural birdies in Justin Rose, is just phenomenal. The fact that, you know, Bryson fell out and Rose came on, and then you had guys like Patrick Reed that potentially could have won it as well. I mean, we've seen a lot of Masters. We've seen a lot of ups and downs. We've seen a lot of wins and losses, right? And certainly Tiger's been a source of a lot of that drama. Phil's been a source of a lot of Jack going back. Even, you know, to the 80s was giving us drama. But that and then the culmination of all it meant, not only for golf, PGA Tour versus LIV, Rory McIlroy and all the demons he had to exercise in terms of not only just Augusta, but another major championship, and then to complete the career Grand Slam. I think it was Paul McGinley, I think, who said it best, that Rory just isn't good at playing defensive golf. He isn't good playing when he's protecting a lead. And he was giving away the lead, getting back in the mix and getting the lead again, giving back the lead. I mean, that was just ebbing and flowing throughout the day. And the guy who hit the off shot from 86 yards is also the guy who hit it to 8 feet from 210 yards. And the same guy who birdied 17 is the guy who dumped it in the bunker from 120 yards and bogeyed the 18th hole to get into a playoff. I mean, it was phenomenal. It was one for the ages.
But see, you just validated my whole lead into this, because that's one of the smartest assessments of the Masters that I've ever heard. Because you looked at the Masters to me, and on Sunday, it was like the two Rorys out there. One of them that was desperate to give this thing away. You know, just seemed destined to choke it up. Let's just say the C word, just to choke on it.
Yeah.
And then the other guy who hit some of the best shots we will ever see, that literally Tiger-esque, on 13 and 15. And it just watching those two guys battling each other in the way that we see Rory so many times at Augusta and in other places too, just sort of fighting with himself, not really fighting the crowd or the other players in the field. They almost have nothing to do with it. They're kind of watching this too. Like, what's he going to do? And I just find it fascinating, this war of the personalities that goes on with him, and having that one player that is successful, that wants to win, finally come through. I think that's the emotion that we saw in him. And we see a lot of emotion, believe me, on 18, on Sunday, on the Masters. But that was truly something different to me.
Yeah, I mean, that was a Crenshaw-esque emotional release or Phil when he won his first. I mean, I don't know. There's been lots, but I just think, if you I've been to Northern Ireland, I've been to Rory's home course, which is a little, it would be probably considered a local municipal kind of a club and course in Northern Ireland, and in Hollywood. It's spelled with one L. It's Hollywood. But I've hung out there and had a few pints there and heard stories about how the older kids would lock them in the locker so that they would have a chance to win the weekly junior tournament or whatever they had. And I mean, he's a little guy. He comes from a little town. He's had to fight his way, to the top. Right. And I think that all, I'm not a psychologist, but I think it filters into the psychology of it all, where he's better coming from behind when nobody expects him to do what he needs to do to win than he is if he's playing for the lead. Like, Tiger had that amazing ability to just lock things down. When he got the lead, that was his. He was, either going to go in the direction of getting a bigger lead or just holding it on, making people try to beat him. And I just don't think it's in Rory's nature. I don't think it's in his DNA. I don't think it's in the way he was sort of learned to play the game. And I think that's been a major block for him, that once he became number one in the world, once he became all the everyone was expecting him to win, he has struggled. And even at the Players' Championship when he won, and it's not a major, but it has that high profile. You can see him get with the putter when he didn't even hit the hole on the eagle putt on 15, didn't even hit the hole from 6 to 8 feet, didn't hit the hole on the 72nd hole when he was trying to make the putt for par, which would have won it. He, you know what I'm saying? Like, he wasn't even coming close. He needed to be, just look at those two snapshots of the approach shots he had on 18, which are essentially from the same, when he had when he essentially had the lead, he dumped it in the bunker. When Rose hit it close and he knew he had to hit a great shot, he knocked it inside Rose and made the birdie. You know what I'm saying? Like, it just, I think it's a fundamental sort of switch that happens for him when he's playing from behind or versus playing with elite. That seems to be a fair assessment.
Well, it's an interesting observation, Dr. Janela, and I will add my theory or observation to him that when you saw what happened on 18, and we've heard that fit that first putt, and you're right, he did not even hit the hole, but it was like there's somebody playing defense. When I go out and teach people the game who haven't played the game before, I make them laugh because they say, okay, you know, you're hitting balls, nobody's blocking the shots, you know, how hard can it be? You know, nobody's playing defense. Yeah. How hard can it be? But with him, it seems like there is somebody playing defense. There's one guy, and it's him. He's playing defense on himself. And I watch this, and you contrast that to his earlier wins, where you have I was at Congressional and saw him go through this incredibly long and difficult course, literally like taking candy from a baby, and he like looking up after 72. Is like, are we done? Are we going to play a fifth day? You know, that's the image that I have of Rory winning. And this is an interesting question. I'll ask you this. So when you look at these two players, the one who is really squeezing and struggling to win, if you might want to put it that way, to one who wins effortlessly, is it early in his career? What do you think, and what do they think, by the way, what do you think is going to be Rory 2.0, or even 3.0? If this is 2.0 winning this, Rory 3.0, the next version of his, will he struggle to win? Or will he win effortlessly, some combination of the two? What do you think?
I think I'm so glad we've got to this question, meaning, you know, not you and I, but like us, the world of golf.
Right.
Because, and I think he said that in the press conference after, what are we going to talk about next year at the Masters? Because I've won the Masters. But now, you think of Quail Hollow and Oakmont and Royal Port Rush, Quail where he loves it, and Oakmont favors long and straight, and Royal Port Rush is, you know, he's played it, you know, countless times as a kid. I think set the course record when he's like, you know, I don't know, a teenager. I mean, he's that's a home game for him. So now you like, now what? Because there's never been a question about his ability. There's never been a question about how he stacks up against his peers. And I think you got the you know, the live guys who are, you know, again, Bryson, you know, Bryson is a live guy who, you know, doesn't have a lot of other things going on in his life. He is consumed by the game. So he just, And money doesn't really matter to him. He's just consumed by the game. So he's going to be there and be in the hunt and the competition. Brooks, DJ, John Rahm seems to have really suffered as it relates to going to live and being a part of that competitive culture. Patrick Reed, played well at Augusta, but there's Cam Smith doesn't seem to be benefiting from less golf and less, you know, competitive golf. So you splinter men's professional golf, and then you've got a lot of guys on the PGA Tour side who have made an obscene amount of money. And even Scotty Scheffler has gotten up and said to us, the people who are listening, golf, it's not the end all be all for me. I'm not, you know, and good for him, right? I'm not saying this is a knock on him. I'm just saying what he's saying to us, which is it doesn't really, whether he wins or loses or he keeps winning forever or never, you know, it doesn't really matter to him. So all that being said, I think it sets up for Rory to go on a run. I think he's, you know, he's mid-30s. He's got all that. Now he's kind of purged a big chunk of baggage. It's like he literally disconnected himself from pulling a massive trailer around every time he stepped on any first tee, certainly as it relates to major championships. Now, I mean, would anybody, if he wins two out of the next three, if he wins three out of the next six, if he wins, you know, five out of the next 15, would anybody be shocked?
Right.
I don't think so.
Right. Right. I totally agree. I think it sets up for the dawn, the potential dawn of a brand new era of something special, something that we haven't seen, dare I say, since Tiger. He has that type of ability to hit the shots that make us go, wow, wow. You know, you watch him play the game.
There are a lot of guys who didn't even win a major until their 30s and then won several after that.
Absolutely.
You know, there is something to be said that now with where Rory's at, having accomplished what he's accomplished, a career Grand Slam, only one of six to do that. And now he's got a little bit of everything. And he seems to be at peace now where he's at with his life. I mean, there's been, you know, and I don't really care what they do off, you know, like, but he's definitely had some things going. I mean, there was a near divorce as it relates. That's a lot.
Yeah.
Off the course. That's a lot to be going through while you're also trying to be, you know, number one in the world and competitive. And then what he did in terms of the face of the tour versus Liv and saying what he said and how he said it, getting the feedback that he got from it. That was a mess, right? Now he's like, he's out of all of that. He seems to be at peace now where he wants to be personally, professionally. He's accomplished, you know, more than you could ever possibly. I mean, he's a, you know, first ballot Hall of Famer, so to speak, as it relates to golf. So now what? I mean, like we said, so take the next 5 years and gets him into his early 40s. 5 times 4 is 20. He's got 20 majors. He's not he. 5 seems like that would be an underestimate
exactly.
of what's possible to me. 25% of the next 5 years of majors, Rory can do that.
Especially when
puts him in elite company.
Absolutely. Especially as you mentioned, when you have Live Tour and you have half the tour, roughly half the tour, maybe more than that, of the competitive guys being hampered by the schedule that they play, being hampered by the lifestyle that they live. When you talk about the Live Tour, you have, it's more like a Jack situation than a Tiger situation, where Jack had fewer players to compete against and made all these amazing things, whereas Tiger had a much more competitive field. I think everybody agrees on that. And still did incredible things. You have Rory, who has the ability and the opportunity. It's coming together. And I just can't wait to see what we see next from him. His attitude, where he goes, what he does. It's going to be fascinating to watch. It's going to be a great story. And we always appreciate a great story in golf. Because to be honest, we don't get that many of them. So to get a great story, to me, is the number one thing. We've got a great story. We've got Rory. And what he does next is going to be followed by everybody, sports fans, not just golf fans, sports fans.
And that's it. That's important. There's very few guys who have ever played the game, let alone who are playing it now, who are transcendent in terms of bringing more people outside of golf to the game. And I do think Bryson has that. That factor. Phil obviously did, and Tiger, of course, you know, set the gold standard beyond, you know, Palmer and Nicklaus. But now I think if Rory loses that Masters, I don't know what happens. And thank God we don't have to even know, and we'll never know. But if Patrick Reed actually wins that Masters and Rory loses it, even beyond Bryson, because I think Bryson would have, but Patrick Reed is just generally despised, not just by the golf world, but like, you know, just, I don't know. He doesn't have it. Right. He's got the evil factor, and that's fine. And that plays a role in sports. I get it. But if he wins that Masters instead of Rory, I don't know where we're at right now, but we don't have to worry about it. And now we get to sit back and enjoy whatever is about to transpire. And I have a feeling it's going to be pretty damn good.
We're talking to General Smart Guy Matt Ginella here on 19th Hole. Michael Williams, your host and Sherpa for this. The last time we talked, I guess I was in Charleston, South Carolina. We were talking on NGCOA, National Golf Course Owners Association, about how the game was going in general and all sorts of things going on. We have National Golf Day this coming week. We have, you know, the game healthier than maybe it's ever been, more courses being built. We have more golfers than we've seen, all this stuff. From your unique vantage point, how's the game doing? Does it look good from where you are?
It does. I'm a little concerned, I'll be honest with you.
Please.
From a sustainability standpoint of not necessarily, I don't know. Yeah, growth, market. I think prices, you know, lots of courses have raised their prices. Lots of courses have been built and are being built. You know, lots of people have joined now multiple clubs. So I just had this conversation, and this is kind of what I said. I mean, there's a lot of great programs out there that, like Youth on Course. I served on the board for 4 years. I'm now a storyteller for Youth on Course. I love Youth on Course subsidizing green fees for kids so they can play for $5 or less. If your kid is not a member of Youth on Course, I strongly suggest go online, look it up, become a member. You're going to have over 2,500 golf courses across the United States that participate. That number's going up. Bank of America has now just gotten involved and is subsidizing memberships to Youth on Course, which then subsidizes rounds of golf. They were running ads throughout the Masters about them getting involved in this program. You got PGA Junior League, which I absolutely love. I got a little guy who's 7. He's not in it yet, but I have friends whose kids are in it. It's incredible, where they wear a jersey and they play scrambles, and it's not necessarily stroke play related at that age. It's more about camaraderie and fun and connecting with other kids their age. It's great, right? I love all that. I think drive, chip, and putt is a little flawed at its core. I get it. We see the wins, the ones who go and get to Augusta and have smiles on their faces and their parents are all happy. But I also see the downside to all that, where kids are not making it or not qualifying, and the parents get upset. That, you know, then the little league parents, that kind of thing comes around.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily love that whole competitive-based grow the game initiative when it relates to do this and you get to do that. And, you know, cause then I think parents get overbearing. And so I think there's some flaws with drive, chip, and putt, but I think First Tee is out there and builds really good, you know, kids who have character, and integrity. It's not necessarily going to get kids out on the course as much, but my point is I do think we have a good base. I do think we have revitalized municipal golf. I do think the short courses are being built and are here to stay. I do think we have the things like Top Golf and simulator golf, and that's going to continue to develop so that golf is not necessarily just go out and play 18 holes at a 6,800 yard golf course and pay that fee. So I like all of that, Michael. I just think that if you're a golf course who hasn't taken the benefits of what's happened the last few years and put it back into your product or your people, and you're a daily fee public golf course, and you haven't improved your product, you're in trouble. If you are a private course that isn't, you know, built on a good membership and got a good golf course and has a good leadership and have, you know, separate yourself with something unique as it relates to top 100, top 250 in the country. If you take that top 10, 20% and you say you're fine forever, right? The, you know, the Cypress Points and the Augusta National, we all know, right? The great privates, they're not going anywhere. They're good.
Absolutely.
And if you take the bottom, the best of the bottom 10 and 20%, the municipals, Winter Park 9 and Goat Hill Park and Golden Gate Park just redid their whole offering, 9-hole par 3 short course. Awesome. If we know they're good, right? The price point's good. The starter set is good. So take the best of the bottom 10 or 20%, and you take the best of the top 10 or 20%. That's 40% of all of golf, right? Now go into the middle. We got 60% in the middle. If you're in the middle there from a price point or a accessibility standpoint, and you haven't invested back in your people or your product, and you don't have something that people want to come back and not only play once, but play again and again. If you're in there and you are next door to a place that's doing it better than you, I have a feeling, given where our economy is going and all that, it's eventually it's too much has been built or two prices have gotten too high, I think you're in trouble. If you're somewhere in the middle and you haven't done it right and you don't have good leadership and you've been just taking that money and putting it in the pockets of whoever owns it or whoever's running it, I think you're in trouble. I do.
I think you're right. You hit it head on. And you mentioned Topgolf, and I think it's very interesting that, you know, we'll take a middle number for how many people are playing golf. Some people say 4 million, some people say 12 million. We'll take a middle number and say 6. Well, you say 6 million are playing the game. There's 60 million that are playing Topgolf. And I think one of the keys is going to be how many people you can get from wanting to hit it into these computerized holes into wanting to be able to hit it into holes on a golf course. And will the golf course be welcoming and accepting of those people as they come to the course? There are some people.
And is it a good experience? That to me,
right.
It comes down to the experience, right? Like, is it going to feel warm and welcome? Is it going to feel like I got value? Because if there's a downturn in the economy, if money becomes more tight, if something, the minute we start evaluating is value and experience. Was it worth my time? Was it worth my money? And that's a relative term, right? That's a relative conversation to each individual. I just know that the places like Bandon Dunes, they don't have to worry because they're delivering on a great experience, great value. But if you're, again, a place like TPC Sawgrass and you got $750 or whatever you're charging and people are losing a bunch of balls and it's like, I don't know. You know what I'm saying? I don't know. And Sawgrass, maybe they're fine, but there's got to be a lot of courses out there that people are going to go, nope, I'm not doing that anymore.
Yeah, I totally agree. The game has to watch out for this. We've seen another boom before, and that was followed by a period where the game fell into a gradual decline and hit a point of struggling. And it took a deadly pandemic to bring us out of it. And it's in a great place right now. And what happens next is up to the leadership that's in the game right now. So as with everything else, we shall see. I want to ask you about you, though. What are you doing these days? Because I know you're always busy, always looking for the next thing in golf. What are you doing now and what do you got planned?
Yeah, I mean, I've come full cycle and circle in terms of when I left Golf Channel. The goal was to, and the vision was to start my own production company and work with destinations and courses and resorts and consult or, you know, tell stories for them, create content for them. And then, you know, a month later, the pandemic hit and I was like, oh no, lifestyle travel. It wasn't a great timing. So yeah. I pivoted and moved into the media space with the boutique media company of Fire Pit Collective and surrounded myself with some very talented people, obviously. Got some money in, not enough, I don't think, to get it all the way to where I wanted it to go. And probably, you know, not probably, definitely got too big too fast, tried to do too much in terms of the production and thought there was going to be more of a market for content than what seemed to be, and had to pivot back into a production company as of last year. So as of, I know, going on about a year ago now, it's the Fire Pit Collective was back to the Fire Pit Productions. And it's just myself with a talented team of people I really like working with. I have a production partner who manages all the assets and does a bulk of the shooting and editing. In Joel Weeb, who's based in Seattle, a very talented guy. Then I have a bunch of shooters all over the country and world, quite frankly, that I'm working with. And I've got clients like Youth on Course. Laura Loma is a golf course in the hill country of Texas that David Kidd is building. I got Coral Mountain, another course in Coachella Valley that David Kidd is building. I just finished 2.5 years of documenting the Pasa Tiempo restoration of all 18 greens by Jim Urbina. And that was an incredible project. And I'm going, leaving next week to go to Ireland again and working with Tourism Ireland on telling stories about family golf and travel. So taking my family with me, no one's doing family golf in the travel space. And so I'm going to, that's where I'm at in my life. I used to do a bunch of buddies trips and I still take them, but I think I'm done telling stories about that, so to speak, because I'd rather go with my little guy or my daughter or both having my wife come along and, you know, her going, you know, she wants to go to the spa while I play. Well, let's do that. Let's do that and see if we can turn that into some stories that can be relatable and people would be interested in watching. So Janela's Journeys is essentially going to become the Janela's Journeys. And I kind of put the podcast on hiatus for now because it was, I was really struggling to turn that into a business model. So I've found some really good clients that I love working with. Them telling stories about, you know, Crazy Mountain Ranch right outside of Bozeman, Montana, where Corin Crenshaw are building a golf course for Sam Burnham. I've been contracted to tell that story, the before, during, and after taking raw land and turning it into a golf course or even beyond and calling it a community. That's what I'm working with.
Well, that sounds incredible, every single bit of it. And I especially like the family part of it, because we do, you know, we think of this thing as a thing that we do with groups, with buddies, a bunch of guys or whatever, a bunch of women, bunch of men, whichever, a group of people. But to think of it as families, that's a whole new unit that needs to be spoken to. And I can't think of anybody else better than you to describe a new way to look at the game. Where can people find you? They want to hear your voice. Where do we find you now?
So yeah, everything I'm doing is on thefirepitproductions.com. So thefirepitproductions.com is the website. And then, you know, obviously my social channels of Instagram is Matt_Janela, and, you know, X is still Matt Janela. And I'm actually still working with Golf Channel. I did some stuff, the week of Waste Management. I was on during the Western Intercollegiate talking about the restoration of Pasa Tiempo. I continue to, you know, partner with Golf Digest from time to time and distribute some of my stories through them. So, you know, it just gives me, having this production company has afforded me a little bit of flexibility and freedom to try to tell some of the stories I love to tell. You know, I did a story recently on the Lee twins who got two Evans scholarships to go to University of Washington.
Wow.
And again, the Golden Gate Park story is not, you know, that's not a story. That's not a project that I'm going to make a living on, but it's a story I love to tell. You know how I promote Goat Hill Park and all that's happening there with John Ashworth. So it just gives me the freedom to do what I want and with who I want to do it with. And I feel very fortunate to be in this position.
Well, we're very fortunate to be able to consume that which you are making. And I just want to say I enjoy it. Everybody in the game enjoys it. And when you have another story to tell, please come to this show where you'll have a soapbox to stand on and a microphone to yell into whenever you feel like it.
I appreciate it. You know, I did that father-daughter a couple years ago in Waterville. And it was such a massive, you know, my wife had three children before we got married through a previous marriage, and we have one together, Bandon, who's seven. And, you know, but I've really been the father, played the father figure and role for our daughter who just turned 21, and going and having that experience in Ireland with her, playing in that father daughter and using the game of golf as that vehicle to really allow us that platform of that camaraderie and connectivity was something that changed my life. It changed our life as a father daughter. It changed our life as a family unit. And now we're going back and to do this Ireland trip again, having she just turned 21, and then playing in the father daughter again this summer at Rosapenna at St. Patrick's is the plan. That's the kind of stuff that I'm leaning into as it relates to my storytelling. And again, 20 years ago, I was different, right? A single running around telling buddy strip stories. Now it's about this. And I hope I can, you know, relate to just as many people back then doing what I did then and how I did it to what we'll do now.
I have no doubts personally. So again, I'll be watching out for it. Again, come back on sometime soon and tell us what you're doing then. And we'll be ready to listen, brother.
Always appreciate you, Michael. And I always love bumping into you in various places and having are the conversations we have. And thanks again for having me on, and look forward to teeing it up at some point soon.
You're so welcome, sir. That is the great Matt Janella. You know, when I think about Matt, I think about, and honestly, I do, I think about this. I think about a quote that somebody made about President Bill Clinton, when they said that the guy could give a speech to an audience that included a 10-year-old and a Nobel laureate, and both of them would enjoy the speech, both of them would have questions about it. And that is Matt. He can relate to an entire range of people better and more fully and completely than almost anybody I know. He is a thoughtful person. He's obviously a warm person, and he has so much knowledge of the game. I can't wait to see what he's going to put out next. It's going to be fantastic. So check out that website. You won't be sorry. Believe me. We'll take a break. We'll come back with more golf and stuff. Michael Williams, 19th hole. Welcome back to the 19th hole, Michael Williams, your host. And I think that there are a lot of names in golf. There are a lot of them that we recognize, names that we recognize from the players on tour who win. Players for us when we have a good day, names that we recognize as exceptional when it comes to golf. And perhaps there is no greater name in the game than Titleist from everything that they have, from balls to clubs, bags, everything that they produce has a special aura, in my opinion. And that is certainly the case for their new line of metal woods. They are spectacular. Joining me today to talk about these woods is somebody who is actually the person who created them. She has done fantastic work for Titleist, and this is really something special. Please welcome Stephanie Luttrell, who is the Metalwood Development Director for Titleist. Stephanie, welcome to the 19th hole.
Thanks, Mike. Happy to be here with you.
My pleasure. Did I pronounce your name correctly? Is it Luttrell? Luttrell? Did I get it right?
You've got it. You've got it 100% right.
Bingo. Yes. One for one. Okay. Let's move on from there. congratulations first off for this wonderful new line of golf clubs. We're going to talk about those in a minute, but first I want to talk a little bit about Titleist. Just going to get at the big picture on the company and what their theory is. How long have you been at Titleist, by the way?
I'm coming up on 18 years this July, so it's been, you know, I could have a high school graduate, you could say, with the time that I've spent here, but it's been amazing to be a part of this brand and to really contribute to delivering superior performing products over the years.
And that you sort of got to where I was going to. Is that sort of the theory of Titleist when it comes to club making? Because, you know, I know a bunch of guys over there. Voke is one of my dear, dear friends. But you guys make literally everything in the bag and the bag. Is there a common thread when it comes to creating things that you live by at Titleist?
I think, you know, first and foremost, as leaders in technology and innovation, one of our goals is always about product performance and how do we help all golfers find more success with the game through product and through technology and through innovation. And so that's what fuels us as an R&D team. We're constantly trying to look at, okay, how in metalwood category, how do I deliver more ball speed? How do I deliver more consistency? How do I deliver more distance, more control? And that transcends down through every product category is what do golfers really want in terms of their performance? And how do we deliver that with discrete product performance attributes?
Oh, that's a really great way of saying it, a really great way of putting it. Thank you for that. And certainly this new line of metalwoods that you've come out with in the GT line seems to deliver that. Talk about what your thought process was going into this new line. Was there any particular result that you were going for, any particular area of improvement that you were aiming for with this line?
Well, GT, it stands for Generational Technology, and it truly was kind of a momentous move for us as we transitioned away from kind of, we had three generations within the Titleist Speed Project, and we had constantly been trying to look towards, okay, what can we do to deliver even more performance? And our former leader of our R&D department, Dan Stone, who we lost to cancer a few years ago, but Dan had been my boss and mentor for 15 years, and he'd always been visionary in terms of saying, okay, we know at some point in time we've taken all titanium constructions as far as we could. We're going to need to turn the page into a multi-material construction. And one of the essences of Titleist Metalwoods in particular is that we're always focused on total performance. We're not looking at one parameter, looking at, you know, inertia as an example and saying, how do I max out inertia, but at the detriment of other performance attributes that players really care about. So when you think about GT, it's taking new technologies that have never been used in golf club head design before, like our proprietary matrix polymer crown, and the way that we've designed and constructed these heads to deliver better center gravity positions, better inertial stability and forgiveness, more aerodynamic head shapes, better face insert design. So it's really checking all of those boxes, and it's doing it in a look, sound, and feel package that players want and that inspire trust and confidence in the address position.
Really interesting, something you just said there at the end. You said the look, sound, and feel package. Talk about that a little bit. What are players looking for, and how do you know it? How do they feed that information back to you?
Well, it's a key kind of attribute of our R&D process, you could say, in that I have weekly meetings with J.J. Van Wiesenbeck. I meet on a monthly basis with Liam McDougall. Both of those gentlemen are leaders within our, what we refer to as our pyramid of influence. And that's that we take feedback directly from our global tours. So whether it be PGA Tour, DP World Tour, LPGA Tour, Korn Ferry Tour, we're constantly having those conversations of what are the best players in the world looking for. But even taking that the next step further, we have a consumer test panel that we utilize at our Oceanside Test Facility, TPI, otherwise known as. And we bring those players in, and they're average golfers, just like you and I, you know, not playing on the professional circuit. And we test and validate each design that we bring to market with those players. We look for their feedback in terms of sound and feel. We look for their feedback in terms of aesthetic attributes, like the fact that in our GT lineup, we've gone with a seamless crown construction. We know that when we can bring something that looks incredibly clean, that it's something that you no longer see those competing lines. You're not wondering, hey, where's the golf club pointed in the address position? And those little kind of small attributes are things that really solidify and really show that we're paying attention to what do golfers truly want out of their metalwoods.
I think I can save you money, because I personally can shoot a 75 or a 95, no problem. Same course, no problem. So I can give you a couple of those players.
We all have that in us, right?
Exactly. My bad guy, I call him Ivan, okay? And he's evil. We don't want to deal with him too much. But that's really fascinating to learn about how things get from the idea stage to the implementation stage at Titleist. And clearly you have something special in these GT clubs. This goes through the entire wood range, if you will, the metal wood range, from the driver all the way through. And you even have a mini driver in there too, which is something that I saw about 10 years ago and is making kind of a comeback. Talk to me about your mini driver. What was the idea behind getting that back into the bag?
Yeah, so, you know, behind me, there's an amazing team that we've got assembled within our R&D department, and Tom Bennett is a key part of that. And Tom leads our design strategy for our fairways and our hybrids. And part of the discussions that I was mentioning that we have with Tour on a weekly basis, JJ and Tom and I got to talking about this shift that we've seen on the PGA Tour, and that players are physically more athletic. They're hitting it longer than ever before on the PGA Tour. And the way that courses are being set up, to some extent, it's taking driver out of their hands in some instances. And they really don't need a three wood any longer to hit into greens on par fives because of the length that they already possess. And so it opened up this opportunity for us to consider, hey, is there a performance that we can really help these players with to be able to push it a little further up the fairway, have more control, have more forgiveness, deliver a larger hitting area, more consistent ball speeds across the face, and really kind of bridge this gap between the driver and the three wood and offer them really optimized performance off the tee, but also in a package that if they needed to hit it off the deck, incredibly playable off the deck. And that is what GT280 is. So as you look at this design and construction, it takes the best attributes of the technology of the GT drivers with the proprietary matrix polymer crown, but we also marry that with the best technologies that we had in our fairway woods and GT with this L cup wrapping face insert. So the way that this driver, mini driver sits, it sits tight to the ground. It's incredibly playable off the ground, but really designed and optimized for off the tee performance to just push it up that fairway a little bit further.
So when you're designing a club like this or any of the clubs in the range, I know you're thinking about the club head. Are you also thinking about the shaft that goes in there to make the club amenable, let's say receptive to any type of shaft that might happen to go in it? Or are you recommending one particular shaft?
Yeah, so we build and design it to be accepting of our three-wood shafts. So the hosel length is actually a little bit longer than a traditional three-wood. It's about a half inch longer. So it builds at 43.5 inches total club length. But you can take with our SureFit hosel adapter, you can install any of our three-wood featured shafts. So if you prefer the Project X Hazardous, or if you prefer the Tensei AV Blue, or the Denali Red CB, all of those shaft options are available. So anything within our current product lineup, as well as an extensive custom matrix, we have those available in our three woods, and those can completely adapt into this new GT280. So if you have a three wood that's already kind of fitting well into your bag, you can transition that performance straight into the mini driver as well.
And as you introduce the product into the world, you have your own fitters, of course, who go out into the world. But now you have this whole new range of places like Club Champion. We can say their name there. How do you educate them on both the benefits and the fitting of these clubs? Because those seem to be very key features. How to actually get the right shaft, the right loft, all these things. How do you get those out to the public?
Well, we've got a great resource within our Titleist University. We also have product specialists and very well-educated sales representatives that are out in the field helping us to, you know, extract this message and disseminate this message to the broader golfing public. We also do a lot of training seminars with those national accounts, as you mentioned. So bringing Club Champion in, bringing PGA Tour Superstore in, bringing Worldwide Golf Teams in. And so we're consistently educating them as to the breadth of product performance within the GT line. When you look at it, one of our design philosophies is also about really identifying player performance needs and making sure we have a product in every category to address those needs. And the mini driver was born out of that conversation. You could say the one product, which is also new this spring, was also born out of those conversations of saying, we know there are players that need more launch, that need more spin. And so delivering that within the GT lineup and making sure that we can address the needs of the avid, dedicated golfer, the player that's going out there and investing their time and that they really enjoy and really kind of try to play this game to the best of their ability. We want to make sure we have a product that fulfills each of those performance needs for the dedicated golfer.
Outstanding. We're talking to Stephanie Luttrell, the Metalwood Development Director at Titleist here on the 19th hole. Michael Williams, your host and Sherpa. I'm fascinated and I can't wait to hit this golf club and I'm going to get, we'll find some way for me to go and do that. But before we go, I want to talk a little bit more about you because you seem to be a fascinating character to me. Did you always dream of golf and golf clubs? Tell me about your history with golf. Did you grow up playing competitively, and how did you come to Titleist?
Well, very kind of you to say that you're fascinated by me. I actually started playing the game a little bit later in life. Now that I say that, I've been playing for quite a long time, but I picked up the game my freshman year of high school. But I do come from a golfing family. My dad has taught everyone in my family the game of golf. So my brother is a head golf professional at Harbor Point Golf Club back in Michigan, which is where I was born and raised. And he's on staff with Titleist as well. And then my mom is, you know, very acclaimed and accredited amateur golfer. She's won several state championships within the Golf Association of Michigan. And so I had been exposed to the game at a very young age. I fell in love with it throughout high school, and I really set my sights on being able to play at the Division I collegiate level. And I was able to walk on and play at the University of Michigan. But I'm a bit of a realist. I think that comes with the engineering mindset. And I knew that I didn't have the depth of experience that would probably take to play at a professional level. And so my father owns his own business. He had always coached my brother and I, find something you love. And if you can turn that into a career path, even on your bad days, it'll still feel like it's fun, right? And I feel right. Incredibly blessed that every single day I get to design toys that the best players in the world get to enjoy, but I also get to enjoy, you get to enjoy, and all of our friends that enjoy this game and love this game get to enjoy. So I decided to study mechanical engineering so that I could then pursue a path in the golf industry in terms of R&D, design and development. My first opportunity was with Callaway as a research engineer. I ran motion capture testing for them for a couple of years, and then I moved from there to Cleveland Golf Company, and I did, that was my first opportunity to move more into design and development, and I worked on their tour products for about 3.5-4 years, worked with Vijay when he was number one in the world, David Tom, Steve Flesh, and worked on drivers all the way through to putters. So anything that was specific to tour there, and ended up creating kind of a category that then launched into marketplace products for them. And then Dan Stone, who I mentioned earlier in this call, he was the vice president of R&D at Cleveland, and Titleist had been pursuing him to come and lead their R&D team for a while. And he pulled me to Titleist. He said, I really believe that your background as a player, as an engineer, and your experience working and delivering to the avid golfer, that it can really make a difference here. And so I've been fortunate enough to now be with the Titleist brand for, as I mentioned, 18 years. And what I love about Titleist and what kind of fuels me and our team is the fact that it truly is about product. Without great product, we have no leverage as a brand, right? And so our goal each and every 2 years that we launch new Metalwoods is, how do we advance performance and how do we deliver measurably better performance for golfers? And it's been exciting that we've been able to do that year over year.
That is fantastic. What a story. And I guess, you know, it seems somewhat condescending, but it would make me a bad journalist if I did not say that you are one of the rare opportunities I get a chance to talk to a woman who's in the game. And does that affect how you do your thing every day? Are you to the point now? I mean, you've been in the business a little bit. So is it something you just don't even notice it? Do you get certain reminders? Is there any sort of little thing that comes up? How does that affect the way you approach what you do?
Well, thank you for the acknowledgement as well. Yeah, there are not a lot of women in R&D and golf, and I do feel as though I get to hold that light up for other women to be that example. I think, you know, the naivety of youth, you could say, when I first started in golf, it probably didn't register that much with me. I'd, for a lot of my life, been the only woman in the room. I'd been a tomboy, played a lot of sports as a youth, and then studying mechanical engineering at University of Michigan. It's also very male dominated, right, in terms of the educational path that I chose to pursue. So when I started working in golf, it wasn't necessarily anything new. I think over the years, as you grow in your wisdom and your experience, you start to recognize it more, and you realize how foundational your position is within the golf landscape. And so It's something that I take seriously. I mentor quite a few women in the industry just to be able to continue to encourage and advance other women to know that there's space for us here at the table. And I think, you know, that's something that Dan really championed, and Chuck, who leads our R&D team now, is a big advocate for, is that differences in perspective, whether it be through your gender, through your culture, are really important foundations to really developing a well-rounded team. And it's been exciting to continue to see us grow and to get to be a part of it.
Well, I got goosebumps here. I really do. I think that's just so well said. And I think, you know, I'm just so interested in what you, not only what you do, how you do it, what drives you to do it. It's all just a good story to me, and hopefully that's what we're all here for. But as you go forward, let me say this, you've got the GT out there. It's doing great. I'm hearing great things about it. What's next? What are you on the drawing board with next?
Well, I'm pretty deep in the weeds. As you know, I just got back from a two-week work business trip over in Asia, working on our next generation. For us, it's how do we continue to push the boundary conditions of performance? Every single generation, as I mentioned, we want to make sure it's measurably better. And so as we look forward from GT, it's how do we continue to leverage the technologies of GT to deliver that, to deliver more distance, to deliver more consistency, to deliver in a package that players want to feel and that looks and sounds the way that they expect. So we're excited. We're deep into it, but it's fun. And that's part of what, you know, fuels us as a team, is that we're passionate about golf, and we're passionate about delivering products and performance. So it's been exciting, and I can't wait for everyone to get to experience it in the future.
Well, I am totally excited about experiencing it in the here and now, and also experiencing what you have to come in the future. Stephanie, you have been a marvelous guest. Thank you so much for taking the time, and we will be sure to get you back on to talk about the next thing and the next thing and the next thing after that that you're bringing to Titleist and to golf.
Appreciate it, Mike. Thank you so much for the time and really the opportunity to get to share about myself and about Titleist Metalwoods.
You're more than welcome, dear. Anytime, anytime. That is Stephanie Luttrell, the Metalwood Development Director at Titleist. Look, first about the clubs. The clubs, I'm hearing great things. I haven't hit one yet, I'll be honest, but I love everything in my bag that is Titleist, so I am sure that I will love this club. There's something about standing over a ball with a Titleist product in your hand or on the ground that makes you feel a certain way. And I do think that feeling a certain way is one of the things that helps you hit good shots. So having the trust in that particular product is important, and nobody builds trust like Titleist. It is, I'm sure, a superior product. I can't wait to hit one. But I really, after talking to Stephanie and getting to know the people who are behind this, how can you not be even that much more excited about the product when you know that quality individuals like Stephanie are behind it. It really just makes me excited to go hit. I got to go to the store. So look, you guys just go ahead, do your thing, but stick around. We got another segment to go. We'll be back with more golf and stuff. Michael Williams, 19th hole. As they say in Turkey, that's it and that's all. That's not in Turkey. I think they say that. That's it and that's all for the 19th hole this episode. We want to thank our very special guest, Matt Janella. What a well of knowledge and insight that he is. I always enjoy talking to him because he always goes a little bit deeper than you thought he would. And I just can't wait to have him back on. I hope you feel the same way. Also, thank you to Stephanie Luttrell and all her good information about the wonderful work they do at Titleist and why she does it. It's really fascinating to hear from a person like Stephanie. And it makes me feel like these efforts to grow the game are really doing something, because the game is growing. The game is better because she's involved in it. I hope you agree with me. She was a wonderful guest, and we can't wait to have her back on. You can get this show and all of the 19th Hole episodes on Apple. You can get them on Apple iTunes. You can get them on Spotify and any of the great, great podcast host sites that are out there in the world today. Thank you more than anything else for joining us. I really appreciate everyone who listens to the show. There's so many people at Oakmont who said that they listened, and every single one of them brought joy in my heart and a tear to my eye. So thank you very much for doing that. So until next time, thank you so much for being with us. We'll see you soon. There'll be more coming up on the U.S. Open and the PGA Championship and all of those good things. But in the meantime, why don't you go out for yourself, hit some balls for yourself, and when you do, try to endeavor to hit them straight. Michael Williams, 19th hole.